Hey everyone, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Before we jump in today, this Deep Dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Yeah, they're great.
They really are. I mean, they've got a full Series 24 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing.
Which is huge for test day.
Oh, absolutely. So check it out at certfuel.com. Keep it casual, but yeah, you need it.
Definitely.
Okay, so let's get into it. Imagine you're a compliance officer, right?
Okay, I'm imagining it. Sounds stressful already.
It is. So an SEC examiner walks into your branch, totally unannounced, flashes a badge, and asks for your electronic communications archive.
Oh boy.
But you aren't worried. You moved everything to this new ultra-cheap cloud storage vendor like a month ago.
Right, feeling confident.
Exactly. You confidently log into the portal to download the files, and this little pop-up appears on your screen. It says, "Please wait 48 to 72 hours for vendor administrative approval to release your archive."
Oh no, that is a nightmare.
The examiner looks at you, you look at the screen, and you just earned your firm a massive fine.
Yeah, and you might honestly be losing your license over that.
Right. So, welcome to the deep dive, everyone.
It is a terrifying scenario, but it happens way more often than you'd think.
I bet.
Yeah, we are unpacking books and records today. Specifically, we're geared toward mastering the architecture of compliance for the Series 24.
Right. And look, if you are, walking the dog right now or doing the dishes, stay with us because your brain actually needs to understand this material to pass.
Yes, it does.
We are not just going to read you like dry retention schedules. That's boring.
It is. And honestly, memorizing spreadsheets of numbers is just a terrible way to learn.
Yeah.
And it's an even worse way to operate in the real world.
For sure.
So the goal today is to understand the actual mechanics of regulatory enforcement. I mean, regulators, they don't just pull these numbers out of thin air.
They don't just roll some dice.
Exactly. There's a very specific, logical reason why
Sure.
one document is kept for 3 years and another one is kept for six.
Right. There's a method to the madness.
Yes. If you understand the why behind the rule, you can reverse engineer almost any tricky scenario they throw at you on test day.
I love that. We are essentially building a mental model today.
That's the idea.
And to keep the dry regulatory text from, putting us straight to sleep, we're going to rely on a recurring cast of characters to sort of anchor these scenarios.
Always helpful.
Yeah, if you've listened before, you know them well. So first, we have Founder Frank.
Oh, Frank.
Yeah, good old Frank. He is the corner-cutting boss who runs his broker-dealer on an absolute shoestring budget.
Right, always looking for a loophole.
Always. Then we have Careless Carl.
Carl is a liability.
He really is. He's a registered rep. He means well, I think, but he is just a walking, talking compliance violation.
A disaster waiting to happen.
And finally, we have Diligent Diane. She is the superstar compliance principal who basically constantly has to clean up their messes.
Poor Diane. But they are the perfect avatars for what not to do.
Exactly.
So to understand what Founder Frank actually has to keep in his filing cabinets or his cloud servers, we first need to establish who is actually punishing him when he inevitably loses those records.
Right, because there's a whole jurisdictional overlap here that candidates, I think, often misinterpret.
They do all the time.
It's not just a single regulator handing down stone tablets from a mountain. We are dealing with three overlapping layers of authority.
Right. Let's build the foundation here.
Right.
At the very bottom, forming the statutory floor, you have the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, the SEA.
Okay, the federal law.
Exactly. That's the federal law. Above that, you have the specific SEC books and records rules.
Okay.
The SEC, they dictate the what and the how. They write the record-making rules, which is what you literally have to create, and the records retention rules, which tell you how long to preserve them and, in what specific format.
Okay, got it.
And then finally, on top of all that, you have the FINRA rules, which add their own specific mandates and timelines on top of the SEC's foundation.
Okay, so I always picture this as like a commercial kitchen.
Okay, I like food analogies.
Right. So the SEC is the head chef and they're writing the master recipes. They say, here is exactly how you bake this specific cake, and here is exactly how long it must stay in the refrigerator.
That's a good way to look at it.
And then the FINRA kitchen staff has to follow those SEC recipes. But FineRod doesn't just rewrite every single SEC rule into their own giant book, right? That would be wildly inefficient.
Oh, incredibly inefficient, yeah.
Yeah.
So instead, FineRod adopts the SEC's record-keeping mechanics through what's called an umbrella rule.
The umbrella rule, okay.
Yeah, that umbrella rule is honestly a brilliant piece of regulatory engineering.
How so?
Well, it essentially says, whatever the SEC requires you to do regarding books and records, FineRod also requires you to do.
Oh, nice and simple.
Mostly. But here is the critical operational detail that you have to know.
Mm.
When the two rule systems specify different retention times for the exact same record, the longer period is the one that legally binds the firm.
Okay, that makes sense. The regulator with the strictest standard sets the bar.
Exactly.
So if the SEC says, you know, you preserve a record for 3 years, FAMR expects 3 years. But if FINRA adds its own specific longer retention floor, say 6 years for a certain type of document, that 6-year rule is what Frank has to follow.
Right. The entire purpose of this umbrella rule is enforcement reach.
Enforcement reach. What do you mean by that?
It gives FINRA examiners the exact same prosecutorial power that SEC examiners have, and they don't have to wait for the SEC to initiate an action.
Oh, I see. Let me test the limits of that, because this seems like an area where test takers might definitely lose points.
Go for it.
Okay. Let's say Founder Frank violates a very specific SEC format rule. Like, he stores his records in a weird, non-compliant electronic format that the SEC explicitly bans.
Typical Frank.
Right. Can FINRA charge him for that formatting failure, even if FINRA doesn't have a specific rule in their own book detailing that exact format?
They absolutely can. And that is a huge blind spot for a lot of people studying this material.
Really?
Yeah. The FINRA umbrella rule turns that SEC format violation into a standalone FINRA offense.
Oh, wow.
It pulls the SEC's technical requirements directly into FINRA's jurisdiction. So if Frank fails to preserve records in a compliant format, FINRA can sanction him for it.
Right then and there.
Yes. And simultaneously, the SEC could pursue him under federal jurisdiction. They can essentially double dip on the enforcement.
Wow. So the umbrella rule isn't just a polite suggestion. It's like a bridge that actually weaponizes SEC rules for FINRA's use.
Precisely. That's a great way to put it.
Sure.
Now, given that overlapping jurisdiction, we really need to talk about the default retention floor.
Okay, the default floor.
Right. If you are looking at a FINRA record and you cannot find a specific rule anywhere stating how long to keep it, what is the fallback?
The fallback is at least 6 years. But the real trick here, and this is where the regulators love to test your reading comprehension on the exam, is knowing when that 6-year clock actually starts ticking.
Exactly. It is not always the day the piece of paper is printed.
No. For account-related records, it is 6 years after the account is closed.
Right.
But for non-account records, it is 6 years after the record is made.
And we should really pause on that distinction, because the why here is very important.
Okay, let's unpack it.
Why do account records stay open-ended while non-account records start ticking immediately?
Yeah, why is that?
It comes down to the ongoing relationship. As long as an account is open, the foundational documents proving, you know, who owns it, their risk tolerance, their identity, those are actively relevant to every single trade placed in that account.
Oh, that makes sense.
Right. The regulators cannot have a firm throwing away a client's original new account form just because the account has been open for 7 years.
So think about this, right? Let me ask the listener a direct question here. Take a second to think about this. Let's say Careless Carl opens a brokerage account for a client back in 2020, and that account is still actively trading today. When does the 6-year retention clock start for those original 2020 account records?
Just think about that for a second.
Right. Got an answer? Well, it hasn't started yet.
Not even a little bit.
Right. Not a single day has ticked off that clock. The 6-year countdown waits in, like, suspended animation until the exact day that account formally closes.
Perfect way to explain it. So a 5-year-old open account still has its original records subject to permanent ongoing retention.
But there is a massive exception to this 6-year default, right? And it has to do with how people actually talk to each other. Communications.
Yes.
Emails, instant messages, social media posts, done for business, all of that.
Right. Communications do not follow the FINRA 6-year default.
Okay.
The SEC has a very specific retention floor for communications, and that floor is 3 years.
3 years instead of 6.
Right. And if you think about the sheer volume of data a modern broker-dealer generates in emails and Slack messages every single day, it makes sense.
Oh, yeah, it would be terabytes of data.
Exactly. Forcing a 6-year default on every single casual internal email would require an absurd amount of server space. So the SEC capped it at 3 years.
Okay, meaning if Founder Frank institutes a strict firm-wide policy that permanently purges all company emails from the servers after exactly 4 years, he's completely fine.
He is.
The SEC rules 3 years, so at 4 years, he is in the clear, despite FINRA having that broader 6-year default for undefined records.
Exactly. Now, if he purges them at 2.5 years, he's facing a massive fine.
Right, obviously.
But at 4 years, he's fully compliant.
Okay.
So now that we understand the broad jurisdiction and the defaults,
mm-hmm.
we need to split this whole topic into two halves.
Okay, two halves.
The making of records and the preserving of records. Let's start with making.
Okay, the making side. This is what I call the supervisory architecture.
I like that term.
Yeah. The SEC's record-making rules dictate that every broker-dealer must create certain specific records simply to prove their supervisory house is in order. It's about assigning blame, or, well, rather, accountability.
Right. Accountability is a nicer word for it.
Yeah.
A great place to start here is the per-office designation.
Okay, what is that?
For every single office of a broker-dealer, the firm must make a formal record listing by name or title, each person at that specific office who could explain the types of records kept there and the information contained within them.
So someone physically there.
Yes. And the regulatory standard for their availability is that they must be able to do this, quote unquote, without delay.
Without delay. Okay, let's put Careless Carl in a scenario here to make this stick.
Always fun.
An SEC examiner walks into a small branch office in Chicago. Carl is the only one sitting at the front desk. The examiner says, I need to see the blotters and the complaint file for this branch.
Yeah.
Carl panics, obviously. He says, look, I just sell mutual funds. I have no idea where the files are, but let me call headquarters in New York. They have a whole compliance team. They'll email it all to you by the end of the day.
And Carl just bought the firm a deficiency finding.
Really? Just for that?
Yep. The per office designation rule exists entirely to prevent that exact runaround. The designation must be office specific.
Okay.
A firm cannot satisfy this requirement by maintaining one giant firm-wide contact list of compliance people sitting in a harm office hundreds of miles away.
Because examiners know that a delay gives a shady firm, you know, time to conveniently lose or maybe alter records before sending them over.
Exactly. The standard isn't that the information is available eventually.
Right.
The standard is without delay. The person designated for that Chicago branch has to be able to walk the examiner through the local records right then and there.
Right then and there. Okay. Next up in the making category is account approval, which you might also hear called dual sign-off.
Yes, dual sign-off. For every single account opened by a natural person, the firm's record must clearly indicate two things. First, the associated person responsible for the account, which would be Careless Carl.
Right.
Second, it must indicate whether the account was approved or accepted by a principal, which would be Diligent Diane.
And here is a subtle detail where candidates often trip up on the exam. This dual sign-off, this proof of principal approval, it must live on the account record itself.
Yes, that is key.
Founder Frank can't just have a separate detached logbook sitting in Diane's office where she just initials a list of new account numbers at the end of the day.
No, he cannot.
The principal approval indication has to be physically or digitally captured at the account record level.
Because if the SEC requests a specific client's account file, that single file must paint the entire picture of responsibility.
Right. The whole story in one place.
Exactly. Who brought the client in and who authorized the firm to take their money? Now, speaking of principals like Diane, we need to draw a very sharp line between two completely different types of supervisory records.
Yes. The architect versus the supervisor.
Right. First, a firm must make a record identifying the designated principal who is responsible for establishing the firm's compliance policies and procedures.
Okay.
That is one requirement. But they also have to maintain FINRA supervisory system records showing who actually supervises whom on a daily basis.
Right. Let me use a movie analogy to separate these because the exam will absolutely try to conflate them and confuse you.
Go for it.
Diligent Diane sits in her office and writes the firm's overarching compliance manual. She designs the intricate policies for how trades get approved. She is the scriptwriter and the set designer for the movie. She creates the world.
I like this.
Right. Yeah. But then you have the day-to-day branch managers out in the field. They are the on-set directors yelling action and actually watching careless Carl to make sure he doesn't mess up his lines.
That is the perfect way to separate them. Examiners want to know the answers to two distinct questions.
Okay, what's question one?
Question one. Who designed this firm's compliance architecture? If the policies themselves are fundamentally broken and illegal, the regulators need to know who wrote them.
Okay.
That is the designated principal wrecker, your scriptwriter, as you said.
Right. And question two, if the policies are totally fine, but careless Carl is just ignoring them, who was supposed to be watching him today?
Exactly.
That information is found in the Feninare supervisory system records, your on-set director.
Right. Architecture versus daily execution. You are required to maintain both records, but they answer entirely different regulatory questions.
Okay, so Diligent Diane spends months creating all these meticulous policies, designations, and account records. Now we cross over into the second half of the equation.
The preservation side.
Right. How does Founder Frank actually store them without getting slapped with fine?
Well, there is a very specific, highly tested timeline regarding the firm's written compliance manuals.
Okay, listener, pretend I'm a game show host. Congratulations, you wrote a brilliant, comprehensive compliance manual. How long do you have to keep it?
Just think about it for a second.
A lot of people logically assume the retention clock starts the day you publish it, right?
And that assumption will definitely cost them points on the exam. The retention period for compliance, supervisory, and procedures manuals is 3 years. But that three-year clock only starts ticking after the manual is superseded.
Meaning replaced or updated?
Yes.
It's like a fire extinguisher. You buy a fire extinguisher for your kitchen. You don't just throw it in the trash 3 years after you buy it.
Right. That would be ridiculous.
You keep it on the wall for 10 years. But when it finally expires and you replace it with a brand new one, the rule basically says you have to keep the old expired fire extinguisher in the closet for 3 years after you replaced it.
It sounds strange when you apply it to a fire extinguisher. But for compliance manuals, the logic is ironclad.
How so?
Imagine Careless Carl gave a client terrible, unauthorized investment advice in 2021. The client doesn't realize they were scammed until 2025, and they file an arbitration claim. During discovery, the regulators and the lawyers, they don't care what Founder Frank's compliance manual says today in 2025.
Right, that doesn't matter.
They need to see the exact manual that was in effect back in 2021. When the bad trade actually happened.
Ah, so you have to keep the historical versions easily accessible so examiners can reconstruct the exact supervisory environment that existed on any given day in the past.
Exactly. If Frank's firm uses the same unmodified written supervisory procedure manual for 12 years, it is still in active use. No 3-year clock has started.
Oh, wow.
But if he completely rewrites the manual in 2024, he must preserve that old superseded version through at least 2027.
And it isn't just full rewrites, right? Like every single incremental update, modification, and page revision is technically its own separate record, subject to its own 3-year after superseded clock. You can't just keep the most recent draft.
Correct. Every version matters. Now let's talk about the physical format of that preservation. Decades ago, this was all paper and filing cabinets.
Boxes and boxes of it.
Yes. Today, it's electronic storage media. There are two permitted standards under the SEC rules for electronic storage, and a firm can choose either one.
Right. Option one is the legacy standard.
Where?
Write once, read many.
Good old worm.
This goes back to the days of CD-ROMs, right? It means the data is in a non-rewritable, non-erasable format. Once it is burned onto the drive, nobody, not even Founder Frank, can ever delete or alter it.
Worm is incredibly secure. But it is notoriously rigid and expensive to maintain in a modern cloud computing environment.
It's clunky.
Very. So regulators introduced option two, which is the 2022 audit trail alternative.
This is much friendlier for modern IT departments, I imagine.
Vastly friendlier. Instead of physically preventing deletion, the audit trail alternative allows the system to recreate an original record if it is somehow modified or deleted.
Oh, nice.
It relies on maintaining a complete, time-stamped, unalterable audit trail of every single change made to the database.
Okay, so if Carl tries to go in and delete a bad email, the system will let the email disappear from his inbox. But the audit trail will perfectly preserve the original email, record the exact time Carl deleted it, and log his user ID.
Exactly. You can't hide from the audit trail.
Yeah.
Both Worm and the audit trail alternative are completely valid. Frank just has to pick one.
Okay.
But regardless of which technology he uses, he has to file something called an access undertaking with FINRA. FINRA acts as the firm's designated examining authority, or DEA.
The excess undertaking. This is essentially a formalized promise, right?
Oh.
Someone has to legally promise the regulators that if the SEC or FINRA demands the records, they will go into the servers, download the files, and hand them over.
Right. And historically, regulators didn't trust the broker-dealers to do this themselves.
I don't blame them.
They required a third party to make this promise. Yeah. It had to be an independent third-party downloader who had the keys to the server.
Okay.
But recent regulatory amendments recognized that this was burdensome. Now firms are allowed to designate an executive officer of their own firm to provide this undertaking in lieu of hiring a third party.
Oh, that's easier.
It is. But here is the trap. You cannot just skip the access undertaking altogether. Someone, either a third-party vendor or an executive officer, must file that formal promise with the DEA.
Okay, let's go back to my scenario from the very beginning of the deep dive.
The cloud storage nightmare.
Yes. Founder Frank is cheap. He decides to use a bargain bin consumer cloud vendor to store all his firm's worm records to save, you know, $50 a month.
Well, of course he does.
The SEC knocks on the door. Frank logs into his Keep Cloud portal to download the files, and a pop-up says, please wait 48 hours for vendor approval to download your archive.
And that is an automatic, severe violation of the independent access requirement.
Automatic.
Yes. If you choose to outsource your electronic storage to a cloud provider or any external vendor, the broker-dealer must have independent access to those records.
Meaning you can't be at the mercy of their IT support ticket system.
Exactly. Independent access means the firm can regularly access, view, and download the records without the intervention, permission, or assistance of the outside vendor.
Got it.
If the vendor can block you, throttle your download speeds, or require a human administrator on their end to approve the data transfer, you are not compliant. You must have unilateral control over retrieving your own data.
So we know how to store things, and we know who has to sign off on them. Let's look at the daily lifespans of the three most highly tested records in the Series 24 curriculum.
These are the daily operational records, and they follow a very specific numerical pattern.
I call this the 6-4-3 ledger play.
Okay, baseball analogy.
Yeah. If you follow baseball, picture a classic double play. The ball goes to the shortstop, who is player number 6, then to second base, who is number 4, and finally to first base, number 3.
6-4-3.
Exactly. 6-4-3. That is the retention ladder you need to lock into your brain for the test.
Let's break those down. Who is playing shortstop at 6 years?
Shortstop is customer account information. This is the heavy stuff. The client's name, tax ID, occupation, whether they are an insider at a public company, the name of the associated person, and the principal's approval signature.
It's the core profile.
Right. And firms actually have to update this information at least every 36 months if they are giving the client investment advice.
And here is where candidates get confused regarding the retention timeline. It is not just 6 years from when the account is opened.
Right. The retention is 6 years after the update AND. 6 years after the account closes.
Think about the mechanics of that. You open an account in 2020. You update the client's information in 2023 because they got a new job.
Okay.
That 2020 original document must be kept for 6 years after the 2023 update. Every single time you refresh the account information, it triggers a brand new 6-year retention clock for the previous version of the record.
Wow. Okay. Because AML, anti-money laundering, and know your customer rules have incredibly long tails. Regulators need to trace the entire historical evolution of a client's profile.
Exactly. And when the account finally closes for good, the very last, most recent version of the account information gets its own final 6-year clock, starting from the date of closure.
A quick side note on accounts here. Specifically, discretionary accounts, where the broker can trade without asking the client first.
Those are highly regulated.
Very. These require a manual dated signature from the person authorized to exercise discretion. Careless Carl cannot just click an electronic checkbox or type his name in a standard font to claim discretionary authority.
No, he can't.
It needs a real, verifiable signature.
The crucial detail for sure. Okay, so customer information is at 6 years. Who is on second base at 4 years?
Second base is written customer complaints. Each office of supervisory jurisdiction has to keep a dedicated file of all written customer complaints, and the retention period for that file is exactly 4 years.
Notice how that 4-year period fits into the broader regulatory architecture.
What do you mean?
It sits right in the middle. It is longer than the SEC's standard 3-year floor for general communications, but it is shorter than FINRA's broad 6-year default floor. It is a highly specific FINRA carve-out.
Why 4 years, though? Why not just lump it in with the 6-year records and make it easier to remember?
It largely aligns with the typical statutory audit cycles and the standard statute of limitations for many civil securities claims.
Oh, I see.
4 years gives FINRA examiners at least 1 or 2 full routine examination cycles to open that complaint file, review it, and identify if Careless Carl has a suspicious pattern of angry clients.
That makes perfect sense. They need enough runway to spot a trend before it disappears.
Exactly.
Finally, who is on first base at 3 years?
First base is negotiable instrument authorizations.
Okay, these are the customer authorizations for things like pre-authorized checks or drafts, specifically where the authorization itself is separate from the physical check.
Right. And what triggers the clock on these?
Well, let me pose this to the listener as a scenario. Think about this. Founder Frank gets a wealthy client to sign a 10-year authorization for pre-authorized checks in the year 2024. Can Frank toss that authorization document into the shredder in 2027 since 3 years have passed?
Give it a thought.
Right. No, he absolutely cannot. And this is a classic blind spot on the exam.
Yeah.
The 3-year clock for authorizations does not start on the day it is signed. It starts on the day the authorization expires.
Yes. If it is a 10-year authorization signed in 2024, it remains active until 2034. You only add the 3-year retention period after the expiration date.
So Frank has to keep that single piece of paper until 2037.
He does.
That is 13 years of total retention.
You have to pay incredibly close attention to the triggers, not just the duration. Customer info keys off the update and the closure. Negotiable instruments key off the expiration.
Before we move completely away from account records, we need to talk about what happens if an account name or designation actually needs to be changed on a trade ticket.
This is a scenario regulators scrutinize heavily because it is extremely ripe for fraud.
Let's bring Careless Carl back.
Always a bad sign.
Carl's having a bad day. He accidentally executes a massive stock buy, but he enters the wrong account number and puts the stock in the wrong client's account.
A fat finger error.
Exactly. He realizes his mistake an hour later. He panics, grabs a red pen, crosses out the wrong account name on the physical order ticket, and writes in the correct client's name to hide his error.
And Carl just committed a massive books and records violation. He likely just bought his branch manager a failure to supervise charge, too.
Over a red pen?
Yes. Any subsequent change in an account name or designation on an executed order ticket requires the explicit written approval of a qualified registered principal.
But diligent Diane can't just blindly sign off on it to make Carl's problem go away, right?
No, she absolutely cannot. The principal's approval must be based on essential facts that actively justify the change.
Essential facts.
Yes. And here's the key. The principal must explicitly record those essential facts in writing, along with their approval signature.
Why so strict? I mean, it seems like a simple clerical error in Carl's case.
Because changing a name on an executed trade ticket is exactly how rogue brokers engage in fraudulent allocation.
Oh, like cherry-picking trades?
Exactly. Imagine Carl buys a risky tech stock for a client. At the end of the day, the stock unexpectedly skyrockets. Carl decides to cross out the client's name and write in his brother-in-law's account number, essentially stealing the profitable trade.
Wow, yeah.
By forcing diligent Diane to document the essential facts of why the name changed, regulators create a paper trail that makes it incredibly difficult to hide that kind of theft.
So a name change is treated as a substantive regulatory event, not a quick clerical fix with some whiteout.
Exactly.
Approval alone is completely insufficient. The justification has to be permanently documented.
Correct. So we've got all these meticulously kept 643 records. But what happens to them when Founder Frank finally decides he has had enough of the stress, shuts down his broker-dealer entirely, and retires to a beach in Florida?
This brings us to the end-of-life phase for a firm, which is governed by the post-cessation rule and a document called Form BDW. That stands for Uniform Request for Broker-Dealer Withdrawal.
The core federal principle here is simple but absolute. The records survive the firm.
The retention clock does not reset or vanish just because the firm closes its doors and unplugs its server.
Yeah, it does.
If Frank shuts down his firm in year 4 of a 6-year retention obligation, those remaining 2 years still apply. The records don't magically disappear into the ether.
But obviously, a closed, non-existent firm cannot hold its own records.
Right.
So FINRA requires the withdrawing firm to legally designate a custodian on the Form BDW. And they are aggressively strict about who is eligible to be that custodian.
There are only 2 acceptable answers for who can hold the records. The custodian must be either a person who was associated with the member firm at the exact time of filing the BDW,
right,
or they must be another current active FINRA/RO member firm. That is the entire list. Frank cannot use his brother-in-law's law firm down the street, and he cannot use some random, unaffiliated physical archive storage facility.
And the timing of the custodian's agreement is heavily tested on the Series 24. When must Frank get this custodian to agree to the job?
The custodian must give affirmative, informed consent before the form BDW is filed with regulators. Frank can't just fill out the online paperwork, forge a signature to push it through, and then call up Careless Carl the next morning and say, "Hey, buddy, bad news. You're the custodian for the next 6 years."
Right. The consent must be affirmative and informed. Frank literally has to explain the Exchange Act and FINRA/RO obligations to the proposed custodian so they understand the massive legal liability they're taking on.
It's a big ask.
It really is. If the proposed custodian refuses, which is common given the liability, the withdrawal of the broker-dealer is blocked by regulators until Frank finds someone who will agree.
Okay, let's assume Frank does find a compliant custodian. Diligent Diane agrees to take on the burden.
Brave Diane.
Diane looks at a warehouse full of Founder Frank's paper files and decides she wants to scan them all to a secure hard drive so she doesn't have to pay rent on the warehouse space. But while she is scanning, she notices a whole box of Carl's old written customer complaints. She thinks, well, the firm is closed anyway, and these complaints make us look terrible. I'll just skip scanning this one box and throw it in a dumpster. Nobody will know.
Diane would be violating federal rules. Format conversion is totally permitted. A custodian is completely allowed to scan legacy paper records into a compliant electronic storage system to save space or migrate older electronic files to a modern format.
Okay, so that part is fine.
Yes. But they must preserve and be able to produce the records in the exact same manner and completeness in which they were originally received.
So digitizing thousands of pages to save physical space is fine, but curating, editing, summarizing, or selectively omitting records during that migration process is strictly prohibited. You cannot weed out the bad stuff under the guise of cleaning up the archive.
Correct. No cherry picking allowed. Yeah. Now let's pivot the scenario a bit. What if, instead of retiring to Florida and shutting down, Founder Frank decides to start a brand new broker-dealer, but to avoid taxes and regulatory headaches, he sets it up in the Bahamas. Can he just keep all of his SEC-required records on a server down in Nassau?
The short answer is no. If Frank registers a non-resident broker-dealer with the SEC, he is subject to the U.S.-based copy mandate.
The mandate.
Yes. He must keep true, correct, complete, and current copies of all SEC-required records at a physical location within the United States.
And you need to pay attention to the word current. Stale duplicates that lag the foreign master records by a few months are not compliant.
I always think of this like an international consulate.
Oh, that's a good analogy.
The real country, like the main broker-dealer operations, is overseas in the Bahamas, but they have this specific building on U.S. soil, the consulate, and it has to be fully staffed with current, up-to-date information at all times.
That's a perfect analogy. Why does this rule exist? Mm-hmm. Because the SEC needs immediate jurisdictional reach. If they suspect Frank is running a boiler room out of the Bahamas, they do not have the time or the patience to deal with international subpoenas, foreign courts, or diplomatic delays just to inspect a broker-dealer's trading blotter.
That makes sense.
By forcing the firm to maintain a real-time U.S.-based copy, the SEC guarantees their own access. And the operational teeth of this rule is the 14-day production window.
Right. The firm has to file a written undertaking agreeing to produce any requested records, completely at the firm's own expense, within 14 days of receiving a written SEC demand.
But here is where candidates get tricked. When does that 14-day clock actually start?
Consider this. The SEC sends a written demand letter by registered mail on May 1st. Frank is out on his yacht in the Caribbean, and he doesn't bother to have his assistant open his U.S. mail until May 10th. When does the 14-day clock start ticking for him to produce the records?
Give it a think, listener.
Well, it starts on May 1st.
Yes, it does.
The clock runs from the exact date the demand was forwarded by registered mail, not when Frank actually decided to read it.
He doesn't get a deadline extension just because he ignored his inbox. The SEC drops the letter in the mail, the clock starts, and production must happen within 2 weeks. No international procedural delays allowed.
Okay, let's bring Frank back on shore. Frank's Bahamas firm eventually goes bankrupt because Careless Carl made too many bad trades.
Classic Carl.
Frank comes back to the U.S. and tries to start over, but his reputation is ruined and he is on a really tight budget. To save money on salaries, he goes out and hires a bunch of registered reps who were just fired from firms that were recently expelled by FishJSA. Welcome to the Cockroach Motel.
The Cockroach Motel. That brings us to the taping rule. This is a severe, heightened supervision regime. It specifically targets firms whose hiring patterns suggest an elevated risk of fraudulent and improper sales practices.
So why does FINRA care where they came from?
The regulatory logic here is based on herd behavior. When a highly disciplined, fraudulent firm gets expelled and shut down by FINRA, the bad actors don't just leave the industry.
Right, they need a job.
Exactly. They tend to migrate together to a new, unsuspecting firm. The taping rule is designed to trap those migrations and force the new firm to create a massive, undeniable paper trail of everything those brokers say to clients.
The trigger for this rule is based purely on hiring reps from disciplined firms, which means firms that have been expelled by FINRA or had their registration revoked by the SEC within a specific 3-year look-back window.
Right, a 3-year look-back.
If a broker left a disciplined firm 4 years ago, they don't count against Frank. But if they left 2 years ago, they're a strike against his firm.
And the thresholds to trigger the taping punishment depend entirely on the total size of Frank's member firm. You must memorize these 3-size bands.
Okay, here are the bands. Take notes. Band 1, small firms, 5 to 9 registered persons. The threshold is 40% or more of your staff coming from disciplined firms.
Okay.
Band 2, medium firms, 10 to 19 registered persons. The threshold is exactly 4 or more reps from disciplined firms.
Pay attention to that one.
And band 3, large firms, 20 or more registered persons. The threshold is 20% or more.
Right. Look very closely at that middle band, the 10 to 19 person firm. Did you notice what is structurally different about it compared to the small and large bands?
Yes, and I really want to do the math on this because it feels contradictory at first glance.
Let's do it.
If I have a 19 person firm and I hire 4 reps from a disciplined firm, 4 divided by 19 is only about 21%. I'm barely over the 20% mark.
Right.
But if I have a 9-person firm, I have to hit a massive 40% concentration to trigger the rule. Why wouldn't I be safe at 21% in a 19-person firm?
You are absolutely not safe. And that is the biggest trap on this entire topic. For the 10 to 19-person band, regulators abandon percentages entirely.
Complete.
It is an absolute count of 4. It does not matter what the percentage calculates out to be. If you have anywhere from 10 to 19 reps and 4 of them are from a disciplined firm, boom, you are instantly a taping firm.
Why did regulators design it that way? It seems weird.
Because a pod of 4 corrupt brokers acting together is dangerous enough to fundamentally alter the culture of a medium-sized firm, regardless of the exact math.
Oh, they feed off each other.
Exactly. The percentages only apply to the smallest firms, where one bad hire might accidentally skew the math too high, and the largest firms, which have the compliance infrastructure to absorb a few bad apples without the whole firm rotting. But that middle tier, 4 bad apples, is the hard limit.
That is incredibly sneaky for an exam question. And it is important to remember that the total size of the firm is based on the firm's total registered person count, not just the customer-facing brokers.
Yes.
If you have 5 back office principals who never talk to clients and 25 sales reps, you are a 30-person firm, which puts you in the large band using the 20% threshold.
Correct.
So what is the actual punishment once founder Frank hits this threshold?
It is severe and expensive. The firm must tape record all telephone conversations between its registered persons and both existing and potential customers.
Frank can't just say, well, Careless Carl and his 3 buddies are the only bad apples from the expelled firm, so I'll just record their calls and leave everyone else alone.
No selective recording is permitted. If the firm triggers the rule, all registered person customer calls across the entire firm must be taped.
Wow.
The firm must establish stringent written supervisory procedures for the taping, conduct periodic reviews of the tapes to ensure clients aren't being lied to, catalog them by person and date, and file quarterly reports detailing their oversight to Fannin or Howe.
And how long do they have to keep these audio files?
3 years from the date the recording was created, with the first 2 years kept in an easily accessible place. Notice how that perfectly matches the SEC's standard 3-year retention floor for communications we discussed earlier.
It all connects. But the real kicker of the taping rule isn't just the server space for the audio files. It is the public shaming.
Oh, yeah. The public shaming.
Taping firm status is publicly disclosed on FINRA broker check. It is not confidential. Any prospective customer can look up Frank's firm online and see a giant red flag stating that the firm operates under heightened taping supervision due to hiring bad actors.
It is a massive intentional reputational hit.
Yeah.
The regulators wanted to act as a structural deterrent, so firms refused to hire these personnel in the first place. However, the regulators do offer a one-time cure if a firm accidentally crosses the threshold due to a merger or a miscalculation.
Right. Frank realizes he made a huge mistake hiring Carl's pod of buddies. He has a one-time option to reduce his staffing levels below the threshold. He has exactly 30 days after receiving official notice from Finer or obtaining actual knowledge of his status to fire enough people to get under the line.
But he must drop strictly below the threshold, not just tie it. If the limit is 4, he has to get down to 3. And he must notify FINRA in writing before or during the reduction process.
Think about this scenario. Frank uses his 30-day window to fire careless Carl. That drops him below the threshold. He breathes a massive sigh of relief. 3 months later, business picks up. He thinks the coast is clear and FINRA has moved on, so he quietly rehires Carl. Does he get away with it?
He does not. Regulators anticipated that exact loophole. There is a strict 180-day no-rehire bar for anyone terminated to accomplish a taping rule reduction.
Half a year.
Yes. You cannot just fire them on paper, wait for the regulators to look away, and bring them back a month later. The reduction has to stick for at least half a year.
And remember, this cure is one time only. If Frank's firm utilizes this reduction option, and then 2 years later they accidentally qualify as a taping firm a second time, the reduction option is completely gone.
Gone forever.
He cannot fire his way out of it again. He just has to buy the microphones and start taping.
Okay, we have covered a massive amount of regulatory ground today. Let's synthesize this.
We are going to do a rapid-fire review of the biggest, most testable concepts we've explored today. If there is one overarching theme to take away, it is that FINRA is obsessed with continuous, unbroken chains of accountability.
Let's run through the timelines.
Default FINRA retention period.
6 years. It starts when the account closes for account records, or when the record is made for non-account records. It acts as a safety net.
The 643 ledger play.
Customer info is 6 years, triggering after every update and again at closure. Written customer complaints are 4 years, giving examiners time to spot trends. Negotiable instruments are 3 years, but the clock only starts after the authorization fully expires.
Compliance manuals.
3 years after the manual is superseded or updated, you have to preserve the historical environment, not just today's rules.
Post-withdrawal custodians on form BDW.
Limited to an associated person of the member at the time of filing or another active FINRA member firm, and they must give affirmative, informed consent before the paperwork is filed.
And finally, the taping rule threshold for a medium-sized 10 to 19-person firm.
An absolute count of 4 disciplined reps. No percentages applied in that middle band.
Beautiful. To wrap up this deep dive, I want to step back and look at where this is all heading. We have spent this entire time talking about physical storage, worm drives, paper manuals, and scanned PDFs. But look at the reality of modern finance.
It is shifting incredibly fast. With the rise of AI-generated communications, voice-cloned avatars giving personalized market updates, and ephemeral messaging apps like WhatsApp or Signal, where texts automatically vanish after 24 hours.
Yeah, how exactly does a firm capture and retain a true and complete record of an AI's real-time advice?
That's the billion-dollar question.
How do you maintain an audit trail for a disappearing text under rules that were largely written during the era of static paper and immutable CD-ROMs?
That is the frontier FINRA is wrestling with right now. The technology is moving faster than the 1934 Exchange Act ever anticipated, and diligent Diane is probably losing sleep over how to enforce it as we speak.
I would be too. Well, keep reverse engineering these rules, keep focusing on the why, and we will see you on the next one.